Marty Moss Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Since the uprising last spring, thousands of Syrians protesting repression by the government of Bashar al-Assad have been killed. Homs has been targeted by the military and has been under almost continuous mortar and rocket bombardment for nearly a month. The United Nations Human Rights Council said that high-level government officials and military leaders are responsible for crimes against humanity and other gross human rights violations. Meanwhile, voters just approved a new draft constitution, and according to the Syrian government, the response was overwhelming. Critics have called the vote and the results a sham. Today on Radio Times, the crisis in Syria, and we begin with Karam Nashar. He's a cyber activist working with Syrian protesters using social media. He's also a PhD candidate at Princeton University. And Karam Nashar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Hi. Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning, and nice to have you. And I do want to talk about homes. What's the word from homes that you have as of today?
Well, in fact, the city continues to be under heavy shelling. The particular neighborhood that has been the target of this continuous campaign of random shelling of residential neighborhood is called Baba Amr. It's been under continuous, as you mentioned, rocket and mortar shelling for the past 23 days, to be specific. Just today, there was a very brave attempt on the part of some Syrian activists to help journalists flee homes, but as a result, we've lost 9 activists. Died as a result of their attempt, and I think 3 others are in the hospital. Mm. So this is the latest that I have from homes.
And there were also some reports, and I know it's hard to get news out of Syria, but reports of people trying to leave the city and being forced back by military forces. Can you answer that or add to that?
I mean, it's been a nightmare, to be honest. I've heard several attempts. I have relatives who got stuck in homes, or either got stuck in one particular neighborhood and couldn't actually leave to others, or managed to leave but then failed to leave homes in its entirety. The entire city is basically besieged by the Assad forces, either the actual army or the security forces. What I know and what I get from, I have a friend who went back to homes he was smuggled back into the city just to be able to provide support, primarily because a lot of the citizen journalists that were tweeting and getting the word out through Skype or Facebook died over the past 25 days. Mm-hmm. And the last time I talked to him was yesterday, and he told me it's life as usual in Homs. Shelling starts at 4:30 in the morning, and it ends at 10 o'clock or 10:30 at night. So this is in Baba Amr in particular, this one particular neighborhood. In other neighborhoods, there are snipers everywhere. People really can't move. There's very little supply of food or medicine. So it's a pretty it's a humanitarian disaster unfolding, and unfortunately against the background of very slow international action to alleviate the suffering of people in homes.
And we heard about the Syrian video blogger who was killed last week, Rami al-Sayed.
Rami al-Sayed, exactly.
Was he someone that you stayed in touch with, although you just said that there have been other bloggers who have been killed in the last couple of days?
Rami had a channel on YouTube and Syria Pioneer, and I never actually talked to him directly, but I have friends who did. We were all part of the same network. They would upload the videos on YouTube on this one particular channel, and through this channel, we would be able to disseminate the videos and send them to, for instance, the media or human rights activists, whether in the Arab world or in the world at large. And then, you know, it was very, very sad when people from Homs and other activists started tweeting. Yeah, as you mentioned, 2 days ago, the very last video that was uploaded on his YouTube channel was the video of his body uploaded by his own brother, because he got killed as a result of the shelling of Baba Amr.
And clearly such a loss. I wonder, though, how you stay in touch, and you mentioned some of that, whether you worry about government, if not censors, government tracking down who you might be communicating with in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Well, activists were very aware of the possibility of the regime shutting down the internet or intercepting their communication channels. And so almost from the very first month of the revolution, and so we're talking about something that has been going on for a year now, we were able, this was the job of the diaspora, basically, to raise funds and buy these satellite-enabled phones and satellite-enabled routers, basically, and smuggle them inside the country to where people were organizing demonstrations and protests. And they would use these phones either to communicate with us or to enable their laptops or computers to have internet connection without being dependent on the state internet server. And so this always opens the channel for us to continue to talk. So in Homs, for instance, for the past 3 days, landlines are not working. The Syrian mobile channels are not, the networks are not working. But these, as a result of these satellite-enabled phones, we've been able to keep in touch with activists on the ground.
And is there, I'm sure there are many things that the protesters want, but is there one issue that everyone agrees on that's protesting the government of Bashar al-Assad?
Well, as you know, when the revolution started, when the uprising started in the first month, people just wanted reform. People wanted gradual democratic reform in the country. But as a result of the brutal repression by the regime, people now will not stop before the overthrow of the Assad regime. There is no chance of reconciliation between, a brutal regime that has been killing people continuously. Now, I think the death toll is over 9,000 people. And the beleaguered Syrian protesters. This is the main goal. In terms of what they expect the international community to provide, I think right now we really hoping for an immediate ceasefire, an immediate stop of the shelling of the residential neighborhoods. I just heard today that the regime rejected or refused the demand of the Red Cross to be able to create safe corridors so that food and medication would be channeled into the most damaged or the most affected areas, primarily Homs, but also in the countryside of Hama and Aleppo and Idlib, and so other areas. Homs is the most affected, but basically this is a war by the regime on the entire Syrian people. We don't know. I mean, the regime has been very, very intransigent, and so I'm worried that there has to be coercive measures one way or the other. There has to be certain threats so that the regime would actually be willing to stop what it's doing now.
Well, let me get your response to this vote, this referendum over the weekend on this new draft constitution. I should add that the U.S. State Department basically called it a sham and a fraud, but the Syrian government talking about overwhelming support for this new constitution. What do you make of that vote?
I mean, it's a farce. Anyone who's lived in Syria knows that no one really goes to vote except people who work in the public administration. They're forced, or people who teach in public schools, they are forced to go and vote so that they don't lose their jobs or they're not arrested. And even when they vote, it's not really that they vote only like one man, one vote. There are all sorts of fraud. We realize that dead people have voted, participated in the referendum or in the election. Sometimes there are names of people who don't even live in the country anymore. So anyone who's lived in Syria knows exactly how these things are organized and what they mean. The running joke among cyber activists over the past 48 hours was that how is it possible that they were able to go through 8 million votes? And this is not electronic voting. This is not, voting through the internet. This is basically people just casting their ballots. 8 million votes, according to the regime, 8 million people participated, and in less than 24 hours, they have full results. It's a farce, and no one really takes it seriously. It's a pity that that certain international powers, such as Russia, for instance, is still trying to make use of such methods by the regime, very known methods by the regime to convey an image that this is a legitimate regime, it's a popular regime, it actually enjoys real support on the ground, whereas reality is very different.
And I'm curious about the effect of the sanctions. There's certainly been talk about ramping up the sanctions even further. Have they been having a destabilizing effect on the government, or has it caused shortages across the country?
Yeah, I don't think sanctions ever work, to be honest. This is my own personal opinion. I think sanctions primarily affect people on the ground. The regime obviously is suffering from a severe economic crisis, but according to several political analysts, it's been supported, continuously supported, not just militarily, which everyone knows about, but in terms of its solvency, its cash solvency, its ability to have money to support its economy by the Iranian government. And so I think, I mean, obviously the key figures in the regime now don't have the ability to leave. The Syrian Central Bank and commercial bank are under heavy restrictions, and so certain people are speculating that in several months the regime will actually, or the government will go bankrupt. But on the ground, I feel that it's not really affecting, it's not limiting the ability of the regime to inflict so much repression and inflict so much violence on the people, and they seem to relentless. And so I am a bit wary of the effects of the sanctions on the regime.
Do you think that requires them some kind of military intervention to remove Bashar al-Assad from power?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've worked as cyber activists, people inside the country and outside. This revolution started on March 15, 2011. We've worked for several months through peaceful means. We wanted to replicate the Tahrir Square moment in Cairo. We thought that we would gather hundreds of thousands of people in several cities, then the military establishment would turn its backs on the Assad regime and they would ask the family to step down or leave. Something very similar to what happened both in Tunisia and Egypt, or even something similar to what happened in Yemen, where there's a deal and the president is given immunity and he just leaves the country. We have failed to accomplish that. In August, we had hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating in Homs and Hama and Deir ez-Zor in several cities, and big demonstrations also even in the two main cities that have been rumored to have stayed out of the revolution, Damascus and Aleppo. And yet, tanks rolled in and continuous shelling of entire neighborhoods and entire parts of the cities have started and has not stopped since then. And so now, not only are we worried of our inability to remove the regime, it's not about overthrowing the regime, it's about the humanitarian disaster. As I said, the regime is not going to stop before it collectively punishes the entire society for what it's been trying to do. And so, yes, I think there has to be first a credible military threat, so a tougher language. Unfortunately, until now, Secretary Clinton, foreign ministers of European countries have been very emphatic, saying, "Well, no, we will never try to replicate the Libyan scenario." I think that encouraged the Syrian regime to that encouraged their defiance, their impunity, and their desire to just continue to do what they're doing in Homs and other parts of the country. And if this tougher language doesn't work, doesn't force the regime to stop, then I think yes, there has to be. The Free Syrian Army has to be equipped. There has to be a buffer zone so that they could actually congregate and be properly provided for or militarized. No-fly zone and possibly an airstrike. No one is calling on the ground the local coordination committees. No one is calling for the deployment of troops on the ground, whether American or otherwise.
Well, Karam, we have to say goodbye, and I appreciate you joining us as well. Stay safe. And Karam Nashar, a cyber activist working with Syrian protesters, we are talking about the crisis in Syria. We have another guest waiting in the wings who will be joining us after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY and serves the entire Delaware Valley community, tackling problems that include high blood pressure, irregular heart rhythms, blocked arteries, and heart failure. Their Women's Heart Health website offers advice from the physicians at Jefferson Heart Institute on heart risk factors, working with your doctor, steps for healthier living, and more at jeffersonhospital.org/womenheart. Thomas Jefferson University Hospital.
After eking out a victory in the Iowa caucuses, Rick Santorum has racked up a few more wins along with some momentum. Now he's looking for an upset in Mitt Romney's home state of Michigan and another state that appeared to be a lock for Romney, Arizona. I'm Robert Siegel. Tonight we'll bring you results, reaction, and analysis. Special coverage of the Michigan and Arizona primaries from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra performs Maurice Ravel's Bolero under Rafael Frubeck de Burgos, plus other Spanish classics. Pepe Romero plays Joaquin Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Bolero and Pepe Romero with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about the crisis in Syria. Just said goodbye to Karim Nashar, a cyber activist working with Syrian protesters using social media. He's actually a PhD candidate at Princeton University. And joining us now is Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, also the author of Syria Comment, and that's a daily newsletter on Syrian politics. And Joshua Landis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you. I've been a fan of yours for 25 years.
So. Oh, well, it's about time we got you on, and I appreciate those comments. Let me also say to our listeners that we're interested in hearing what you think, in this case, the United States should or shouldn't do when it comes to Syria, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me begin with these UN investigators saying the government and military leadership are responsible for crimes against humanity, other gross human rights violations in Syria, targeting protesting groups or protest groups, and also targeting civilians. Is that a credible critical report?
Sure, it is. You know, there's a war going on. There's a revolution, and the government is trying to hang on, and that's so. It's killing people.
And killing people and killing people specifically in places like Homs, and we're hearing about other parts of the country as well. Why Homs?
Homs is Syria's third largest city. It's a provincial city. It's agricultural. There are a number of reasons. It's at the fault line of the sects in Syria. That means between Alawites and Sunnis. But it's also, it represents this big agricultural center region that's been hit so hard economically. And it's a Sunni, traditionally it's a Sunni city. So Homs has played a central role in Syrian politics for centuries. And it comes, and it's also close to Lebanon, where one can smuggle in weapons and so forth. So it's at a very important sort of strategic position, where it represents all the fault lines in Syrian society.
And Karim was talking about the protest movement. He has connections with the protest movement, saying essentially it's been almost a year since they took to the streets and demanded reforms and change from the government of Bashar al-Assad. They feel as if there has been no progress on that front, and that it's time for him to go.
Right. Well, this is a major revolution. It's a grassroots revolution, and it's spread to most of the agricultural regions. The two major cities, Damascus and Aleppo, which have been spoiled by the regime in many ways, are middle class, upper middle class, at least in the center of the cities, and have about 50% of the population haven't really joined in. And that's been the strength of the regime so far. The regime has mostly the minorities that support it passively or some actively, and that's about 25% of the population. Alawites, 12%, that's a Shiite offshoot. Christians, almost 10%. Druze, Ismailis, and others. Increasingly, minorities are moving, are sitting on their hands. They don't know what to do.
Well, are they afraid? I mean, are they afraid of their government?
Yes, everybody's afraid of their government. I mean, Syria is not a... but the government offers some kind of control and order. And what they really are afraid of is an Iraq-type situation. And, you know, if you're a Christian in Syria, you look at the Middle East and you see a very bleak world. You know, Anatolia, Turkey, was 20% Christian before the First World War. All of those Christians were either killed or kicked out of the country by the 1922. The Armenians, 1.5 million killed. Others fled. 1.5 million Christians were exported to Greece and Syria. So a lot of Syrians Christians already were kicked out of a country just 100 years ago. And then there are Christians from Iraq who fled. 300,000 Christians fled from Iraq. Almost half the Iraqi population of Christians fled because of the American invasion and the lawlessness that ensued civil war. So they've watched the civil war in Lebanon, which took power from the Christians. And they they're happy to, you know, many of them are happy to give up democracy for stability. That's a terrible situation in the region, because you're sitting with one side in Lebanon, one side Iraq on the other side. So you don't know. You want democracy. You want freedom. You know the regime has been oppressive. It's been authoritarian. It's a minoritarian regime. And it's not going to survive. But you don't know what to do.
Well, and even Karim was talking about Libya, the fact that NATO, U.S. Used air power to get rid of that particular repressive government. Does that, and of course every country is different, and certainly in the Middle East every country is different, but what are the risks of that kind of intervention, a military airstrike intervention?
Well, it seems quite distant right now. You know, Hillary Clinton and President Obama made it very clear that America does not intend to lead the fight in Syria. You know, Obama's trying to, he just got out of Iraq. He's trying to get out of Afghanistan. Both of those, I guess, you know, at least the Democrats see as being relatively unsuccessful nation-building adventures, and they don't want to get into a third. And that's the, you know, that's, I think, the overriding thing, is there's an election going on. His platform is, let's get out of the Middle East and stop spending money. And he doesn't want to get into a third major battleground in the Middle East, because Syria's 24 million people, and it's the center of a very complicated region. And it's there's a democracy versus tyranny element to this revolution, but there's also an ethnic struggle, like in Iraq against Saddam Hussein, where you saw Shiites push the Sunnis aside, and they came to the top of society, and the Sunnis went down to the bottom. And something like that is going to take place with Syria, except for in reverse. The Sunnis are going to come to the top, and the Shiites will go down to the bottom.
And, of course, the reverse of that in many ways is the fact that, and if you look at Rwanda, you look at Bosnia, when people were being killed by their own government, and in some cases killed by their own neighbors and family members, and the world did not intervene, and you know, there raises a philosophical, moral questions about what you do when you know and you hear about the kind of brutality that's taking place in Syria today.
And Bosnia, you know, in Yugoslavia, they entered, and of course they divided the country up into different sub-countries in order to separate the different religious communities. And, you know, does America want to get into that, try to divide up Syria? I think the Arabs would go... It's hard to know exactly what you should do, what your role is in bringing peace, because once you decapitate the regime, an oppressive regime like Saddam Hussein's or the Syrian regime, then you potentially have a civil war in your hands, and you have to decide, then do you get in and try to manage the civil war, or do you just let them fight it out? And you know, potentially the death rate could go up rather than go down.
Karim was critical of sanctions. He wouldn't be the first person who has raised concerns and criticism about the effectiveness of sanctions. Where do you stand on that? And do you think that they could have a destabilizing effect on the regime of Bashar al-Assad?
Well, they already are having a destabilizing effect. You know, the opposition, the Syrian National Council, was the real driver for these sanctions. They came out early, they called hard, they wanted sanctions, because they knew the West wasn't going to send in their military, and they needed to have something to drive forward the revolutionary process and create a crisis in Syria. The trouble with sanctions, as Karim, I think, very correctly put it, is they're going to hit the most vulnerable people, and they have already in Syria. You know, you take away the money from Syrian economy, and it's not the troops who are going to suffer first. The government is going to pay the troops. They're not going to stop paying the troops. What they do is they've slashed subsidies. And they used to spend about $7 or $8 billion a year subsidizing fuel, wheat, cooking oil, all the basic products. This is how, you know, this was the authoritarian bargain in Syria. The government ruled with an iron fist, and it subsidized people, gave them jobs, that do-nothing jobs in the government. It provided some stability, teeny little salaries, and some equality. That was the way it was in the 60s and 70s. That authoritarian bargain broke down across the Middle East, which is one of the reasons why we've seen this Arab Spring. And it's because commodity prices, wheat prices, inflation has driven up farm products. There's been a big drought in Syria for 5 years. The agricultural region has been hammered. The average basket of goods for Syrians has gone up 20% last year of food. And the UN... the last statistics for 2010 said that 32% of Syrians, 32%, live on $2 a day or less. I mean, the poverty is crushing.
And it sounds like growing.
Oh, the Syrian pound just collapsed and fell by 50%. Syrians have lost 50%. You know, it's probably 50% of Syrians today are living on $2 a day or less. There is going to be widespread hunger and poverty, and then a refugee problem coming out of these sanctions. We saw in Iraq, which had very heavy sanctions for a decade in the 90s, placed by the UN. The UN itself estimated that over a third of a million Iraqis died because of those sanctions, and you know, it caused this big it was one of the drivers for the refugee problem and destabilizing of Iraq after the Americans went in, because the institutions, national institutions, had collapsed. People were hungry, hospitals weren't working, neither were schools, because there was no money. And so when you hit a country with sanctions like that, if you leave them on for a long time, people are going to starve. What else can they do?
Indeed. Well, so sanctions have these negative consequences. There are risks to a military strike or military intervention. What does that leave? Diplomacy?
Well, you know, America and the world are thinking about arming the Syrian opposition. Rather than sending in the jets and doing this close air-ground support, you funnel in arms, like Afghanistan, where the Mujahideen in the, you know, after the Soviet invasion in 79, we and the Saudis went 50-50 on funding the Mujahideen and getting them Stinger missiles and other arms. And they completely bedeviled the Russians by shooting them down and pecking them off and drove them out. And I think that will be the scenario for Syria.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, also the author of Syria Comment, and that's a daily newsletter on Syrian politics. We are talking about the crisis in Syria, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We're interested in what you think the international community, including the United States, should do. Should the U.S. intervene in some way? Should we stand on the sidelines? Will diplomacy work? What are the risks of a military intervention? And certainly raising questions about sanctions as well. 1-888-477-9499. Let me try. You okay there?
I'm fine.
Okay, let me get Joe from South Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I haven't heard much about the Kurds in the coverage, and my question is two-part. First of all, what are Syria's Kurds doing? Are they part of the insurgency? Are they part of the regime? Are their loyalties split? And then secondly, how are the Kurds affecting the decisions of both Turkey's government and Iraq's government in dealing with the Syria situation?
Thanks, Joe. Go ahead, Joshua.
Well, that's an excellent question. The Kurds in Syria are about 10% of the population. They see some risks in this revolution, but they see many possible benefits. And some of them have already come their way, because both the government, Bashar al-Assad, and the opposition are wooing the Kurds and want the Kurds on their side. So Bashar has already offered the Kurds, there were several hundred thousand Kurds that didn't have national standing because they'd fled from Turkey ages ago and never gotten citizenship, and some had it revoked from them in the 60s. He gave them all citizenship and tried to fix them up in order to keep them sweet for the government. The opposition, the Kurds have been asking the opposition for national rights and recognition of their separate language and their cultural rights and some political rights in this northeastern area of Syria where they're most heavily situated. So, you know, the Arabs are both, you know, traditionally there's been tension between the Kurds and Arabs because Arabs think that the Kurds want to hive off and secede from Syria and join a greater Kurdistan that has already become established in northern Iraq. We saw with the quasi-independence of the Kurds there. But also, this could reanimate the Kurdish problem in Turkey. And that's why Turkey is so loath to really jump in to the Syria and take the lead in this struggle in Syria. And America's been pushing Turkey to sort of lead the way and that they would support behind. But Turkey sees this as if the regime collapses in Syria, it's possible that the Kurds will use a collapse of central authority in order to secede and join and make larger this Kurdistan in northern Iraq. That would mean that Syria loses some of its important oil territory. It would cause, you know, bloody civil war because there's Arabs thickly sown throughout the Kurdish region, And, you know, it would just lead to greater chaos in Syria. And so it's a tinderbox. That's the trouble, is that, you know, when the colonial powers moved out of the region, they had drawn drawn countries around this complicated multi-ethnic empire where various religious minorities, ethnic minorities left in the same country. And they haven't really found a way to live with each other in any of the 11 countries. We see Iraq struggling with this problem, Lebanon, 15-year civil war. Arab-Israeli conflict is really just a conflict over Muslims, between Muslims and Jews, over who's going to own Palestine, and that's not resolved. So the Syrian problem, you know, once it's opened up, has the potential to bring up all these other sort of latent problems, like the Kurdish question in Syria.
And looking at the opposition in Syria, is it, how organized is it? Are there leaders that have risen to the top? How do you see that movement?
Well, Syria, you know, this is, Syria's opposition is very badly organized at this point. Now, one shouldn't blame the opposition for that, because they've been living under a tyranny for 40 years and there's been no political life. On the other hand, Syria has never had a good opposition. It's never had a really successful political national community that's worked out a way of governing. In the 50s and 60s, when there was freedom in Syria, relative freedom, Syria was the banana republic of the Middle East. There were about 20 different coups and attempted coups in a 20-year period, from independence, 46, to when Hafez al-Assad took power in the 70s, in the 1970s.
And that's Bashar's father, yeah.
Bashar's father. And in a sense, stabilized Syria. Of course, he stabilized it by, you know, being a tyrant. And so people are leery, especially the older generation in Syria, are worried about slipping back into some kind of, you know, that freedom would mean some kind of political instability. And if you're young, that's a good risk, because you figure if Syria goes through a 10-year period of civil war and instability, you're only going to be 30 when you come out of that, and you're going to have the rest of your life to live. But if you're 50 years old, you don't want to go into that, because then you're worried that you're just, it's the end for you. And that's the, you know, there's a generational aspect to this.
We're about a minute from our second break here. I want to pick up on something you said, and it sounds like you're suggesting, of all the difficult options, that arming the Free Syria Army might have some positive consequences.
You know, it depends what you want. If you want to open up Syria like a clam, you know, then you definitely have to pour in the weapons and take the fight to this regime and try to bring it down. You know, America clearly doesn't have the taste for doing close ground air support like it did in Libya. And I think that, you know, that the reason they don't want to do it is that once you commit yourself to breaking Syria apart or breaking up this government, you know, decapitating the government, and the whole regime is going to collapse. This is like Iraq. Because the Ba'ath Party populates the major ministries in the government. The army has been jammed with Alawites and people loyal to the president. That's his religious sect. So when the revolution, which is led by Sunnis, takes over the state, they're going to go through all of the government institutions with a fine-tooth comb, and they're going to dump the Alawites who are disloyal to them. Many who are closest to the president or have done bad things or considered to be, you know, anti-revolutionaries. And so they're going to have to rip the whole place apart. And that's the danger. And America doesn't really want to own this, because then you have to put it back together again. And we haven't had much luck at nation building in the Middle East.
Well, hold on to that thought. We have to take another short break. Again, talking with Joshua Landis about the crisis in Syria and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
St. Joseph's University Graduate Studies in the Arts and Sciences supports WHYY and offers over 41 full and part-time master's and certificate programs on campus or online. A cohort is forming now for the Interdisciplinary Doctorate in Educational Leadership, a program that prepares new leaders marked by the vision, skills, and values to help shape the future of education. Information at sju.edu/edd. Graduate Studies at St. Joseph's University. Higher knowledge, higher potential.
On the next Fresh Air, as the anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster approaches, investigative reporter Dan Edge reconstructs the crisis.
All the workers we spoke to said that, you know, after that massive earthquake, they were completely sure everything was fine because this is Japan, and nuclear power is safe in Japan. You know, this is 1 minute before the tsunami hit.
Edge's frontline documentary is Inside Japan's Nuclear Meltdown. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. When is a military suicide a casualty of war? A Marine's family struggles for compensation after his PTSD-related death. Also, Montana's AG considers criminal charges against Three Cups of Tea author Greg Mortensen for fraud and mismanagement. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about the crisis in Syria, and our guest is Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, author of Syria Comment, and that's a daily newsletter on Syrian politics. And as we all know, the crisis in Syria is frankly getting worse. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Josh, let me get Steve from Perkasie to join us on Radio Times. And Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I really liked what Josh was saying, but I just want to add that that I think that the U.S. Really has a decision to make in the Middle East, whether or not it's going to allow for allow for countries like Syria to attack their own people, regardless of what the international community thinks. We certainly showed with Libya that we had an ability and that we had a moral cause to help the Libyan people. In Egypt, we didn't intervene, and that played out peacefully, relatively speaking. But as far as Syria is concerned, the violence has just gotten out of hand, and I think that the U.S. has a decision to make whether or not it is going to allow this to continue, considering that we have something that we can do.
And from your perspective, Steve, you're saying what we can do is to use air force or air strikes. We touched on this earlier, Joshua, but I'd like to have you respond to Steve's call. Go ahead.
Well, I understand Steve's, there is a humanitarian crisis unfolding in Syria. And if America can make Syria better, then it has an obligation to go in and stop the killing. And I understand that. The question is, can you stop the killing? That's the question. And if the opposition were united, and you had a sense that if you decapitated the regime and the military fell apart, that there was an alternative military that could step in and keep order instead of, you know, allowing carjackings or other kind of lawlessness, as we saw in Iraq, break out and looting and so forth. You don't know what's going to happen once you decapitate a regime. Mm. And if this is, I think, one of the dilemmas that Hillary Clinton is facing, is she didn't recognize the Syrian National Council at Tunis on Friday as the opposition, in part because they don't know if it's going to turn out to be another Ahmed Shalabi or like the Iraqi National Council, which turned out to have no leverage once they decapitated Iraq's regime, and then the civil war started and America was left holding the bag in Iraq. Who are you going to put into power? And just a little while ago, I was on Charlie Rose with both Thomas Friedman and Fuad Ajami, two people I really respect and who know the Middle East well. They were saying we should intervene today in Syria with airplane power because it worked out in Iraq. We can do this. And, I liked them too much to have gotten into a fight with them on Charlie Rose, but I don't know if we really were successful in Iraq. I don't, on Friday, just last Friday, there were more people killed in Iraq than there were in Syria because of car bombs and so forth. I don't think the power sharing formula that we instituted in Iraq has really worked out. Since we've left, most of the Sunnis have been driven out, and the violence has gone up, and the Shiites are consolidating their hold. Now, of course, putting the Shiites in power in Iraq, which are 60, represent 60% of the population, over the Sunnis, who are 20%, and throwing them out of government is probably a good thing, because before it was 20% ruling over the rest, and that was very tyrannical.
So at least you get majority rule out of
it. So you get a majority rule,
and
but it's been 10 years of very difficult changeover, and it's not finished yet.
Steve, thanks for calling in. Josh, let me read something from Mother Jones, and you're actually quoted in this article, and the first couple of sentences say, a 718-page digital document obtained by Mother Jones contains names, phone numbers, neighborhoods, and alleged activities of thousands of dissidents apparently targeted by the Syrian government. And they go on from there to talk about having some experts look at them to try to figure out if this document is authentic or not. Again, you're quoted in this article. What do you make of this document that Mother Jones has?
Well, it's quite extraordinary that it's out, because Syria has many Mukhabarat, or intelligence agencies, internal police agencies, and they're constantly investigating people, pulling them out of bed, pressuring them, getting the information. And since this revolution started a year ago, that business has undoubtedly just exploded. We know that tens of thousands of people have been arrested. And these are rap sheets. These are, people. It was different agencies. That was the interesting thing, is that somebody has smuggled this out. So you can see that the regime is getting weaker and weaker and losing its legitimacy, because even in the intelligence agencies, people are beginning to sneak things out. So here we see these spreadsheets, which had names on the one side, and then, this guy demonstrated here. This guy's
exactly
smuggling arms.
Exactly.
This guy did this. And it just went down one after the other, what neighborhood they live in, cell phone numbers, when they had it, very spotty information, but it was just one rap sheet after the next. And you could see that the intelligence agencies were just overwhelmed by this grassroots revolution. They don't know where to begin or how to, how to get the leadership. They don't know who the leadership is.
But meanwhile, and I'm looking at something from the Washington Post today, the bodies of dozens of men were found dumped on wasteland on the outskirts of the stricken city of Homs on Monday in what appeared to be one of the worst instances of mass killing since the uprising against the president that began in March. So whether this document led to the deaths of these dozens of men, nonetheless, people are being butchered, murdered in their own country.
Well, they're bombarding these three Sunni neighborhoods, which had set up roadblocks and really become a liberated territory for a number of months. And the government decided that it's going to take back that territory. It didn't want to let a Benghazi situation begin, because as the Syrian opposition gets armed and organized and has developed quite a good leadership in Homs, they realize that if they leave this for too long, it's going to get legs of its own, and it's going to spread over big hunks of the countryside, and they'll come falling down. So they're pounding it, and these seems to be bodies from that that they've tried to. I don't know what the situation is, but we're going to see undoubtedly a lot more of that.
But I'm wondering about Syria's neighbors and even the Arab League, even not its direct neighbors, but that whole region. This has to be very troublesome for even some of the dictators in this region to see what's going on in Syria.
Well, it is, and the Arab League has been extremely divided over this. And one of the hopes of the West was that they could put the ball in the Arab League's court, as the Arab League would take charge of this Syrian revolution, and so the UN wouldn't have to do it, or the Security Council in the United States. The Arab League failed to do this, in part because they sent in monitors, which, even though that was largely criticized, it worked, because the death rate was held down, and it was as soon as those monitors were pulled out, the attack on Homs started and the death rate went up. But Qatar, the little island state of Qatar, which has 200,000 population, the emir of Qatar said, we've got to go in, a military invasion, an Arab invasion, and we should go settle this. The Saudis immediately panicked. They said, absolutely not, we're not going to do that. And they insisted to turn it all over to the UN Security Council, where the Russians and Chinese vetoed it. But the Saudis, of course, have their own problems. They've got a 15% Shiite population along the Arabian or Persian Gulf. And they've, some of them in Qatif and other places, have been calling for the death of the Saudi family, and they've, in Bahrain, a majority Shiite country, has been trying to get rid of its Sunni leaders, and they've put that down pretty harshly. So they don't want to set the precedent of sending Arab League troops into countries to make democracy and to get rid of kings, dictators, because that's going to mean the entire Gulf region will have to be invaded by the Arab League.
Well, let me get Ken from Allentown to join our conversation. And, Ken, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You just touched on part of my question with Russia and China. With our dialogue with China seeming to improve each year, how is this going to affect our relationship with them if we get more involved and the Arab nations get more involved with China? And do you ever see China or Russia supplying arms to Syria?
Thank you very much
for taking my call.
You're welcome, Kenya. Go ahead, Josh.
Well, Russia is already the main arms supplier for Syria, Russia and Iran, but Russia is the main arms supplier. And it's committed, it seems to be committed to Syria. Syria offers Russia a major port, its only port in the Mediterranean for rebuilding this Russian fleet. It has been a longtime strategic partner. It offers Russia a window seat at the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is good for Russian reach. And, you know, for both those countries, what this is really about in many ways is Iran. Because the America is, of course, trying to bring down the Iranian regime as well, and will turn to up the ante against Iran should Syria fall. So Syria is really important, both for the United States and for Russia and China, because of Iran. Iran is the number two oil and gas reserves in the Middle East after Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is America's ally. But because of the embargo, China and India and Russia have invested billions in developing Iran's oil fields. And, you know, China is the biggest importer of Middle Eastern oil. Middle East means much more in terms of security, oil security, to China than it does to America. And here America is trying to take down the regimes that supply China with its oil. So China sees this as potentially very inflationary and driving up its costs, and it will hurt its middle class and its attempt to bring hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And I was in China not long ago on an oil discussion between East and West about the Middle East. And the Chinese said, "Why are you doing this to us? Why are you trying to drive up the price of oil and stop our, you know, miracle?" And they saw this almost as an American conspiracy to hurt China. I was astounded.
Wow. Ken, thanks for the call. Let's see what Richard from Kennett Square has to say. And Richard, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'll make this real quick, but frankly, I think that the United States ought to stay the heck out of Syria and let them work it out themselves. The question I have for your guest is, do you think that the people in the Middle East are rational enough to be able to govern themselves in a democratic fashion? It seems to me that the only thing that they pay any attention to is the point of a gun. And, you know, you look at these crazy people jumping up and down in the streets and screaming Allah Akbar and all that crazy stuff.
Well, Richard, let me just stop you there, because you're making a broad generalization and you're talking about a whole group of people, using a small example to use a broad stereotype for a group of people. But let me get a response from Josh Landis.
Well, I guess, unfortunately, your caller probably has a lot of sympathizers in the Middle East, and particularly amongst the Syrian government. You know, a number of government officials have said to me in the past, you know, the people need a strong hand. That's mm-hmm. the line, because they're like wolves. You let them off. If you let them go, they're going to bite your face off. And that is an attitude of ruling elites in the Middle East, and it's what upholds the authoritarian regimes. Mm-hmm. And but of course, if you look at it from a different point of view, this is a nation, you know, people in the Middle East are trying to build nations, and to do that is very difficult. And we can't forget that in the United States here, during the Civil War, Americans, one out of 64 Americans were casualties, 600,000 Americans, and that was in a population of 24 million, the size of Syria. Americans can butcher each other. The 30 years Civil War of Europe from 1914 to 45. What, 50 million people? More than 50 million people were killed in Europe. I mean, civilized people, Europeans, Americans, can kill each other in droves over national issues about where boundaries are, who should be ruling, what kind of nation you want. And unfortunately, the Middle East is still emerging through this very beginning part of nation building, where a multi-ethnic empire has been divided. So things like Yugoslavia, what Czechoslovakia did it peacefully, but other countries which are beginning to emerge out of these multi-ethnic empires are going through the same experience. So I don't think it's Arabs or Muslims. In fact, in the Middle East, it's been a lot less bloody than it has been in the West. I guess it's because they're not as good at killing each other as Europeans, perhaps.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes. I have one or two questions here. One of the alternative or even suggestions that I've read about is to create some kind of safe corridors or safe humanitarian areas where people can be safe from attack. Now, I don't know how realistic this is based on your descriptions of what's going on inside of Syria, but does that make any sense to you?
You know, the opposition is calling for that because it's all about humanitarianism, and the trouble is, if you go in for those humanitarian reasons, you've got to destroy the Syrian regime and the Syrian army, which is going to see this as an invasion in their country, and they're going to fight against it. And that means you have to then stop them from fighting against it and destroy their military. So it's another word for close air ground support and taking on the Syrian regime.
Mm. So where do you see this going? I mean, I see the standoff. It has obviously terrible implications for a lot of people living in Syria and the neighborhood. What are you going to be watching in the next, let's say, year?
Well, my fear is that it gets a lot worse before it gets better. Mm. And, you know, this is the first year of this conflict. In Iraq, it really took 3 years for the sectarian fight to become a civil war. Yeah. Was with the bombing of the Ibn Askari Mosque in 2006, and that was 3 years after we invaded in 2003. And then Shiites and Sunnis really went after each other. I don't think it's going to be anything as long as that in Syria. The Alawites are only 12% of the population. It doesn't have the oil resources, the money. But I see something very dark like that in the future, because this regime is not going to compromise. And they are determined that they're right, and that this is a conspiracy against them. Mm. And they're frightened of what's going to happen to them. So they're going to fight. And the opposition is fed up. And they're going to fight, too. And I see this as a long, drawn-out battle.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, even as troublesome as our conversation was.
I wish I could be more
No, that's
positive.
Okay. We want the truth as close as we can get. Joshua Landis, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Mike.
You're welcome. And he's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, author of Syria Comment, and that's a daily newsletter on Syrian politics. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.